and everything about the neutrino extension of the standard model, which will set us up then for the later in the week when we'll try to see how there's sort of a more elegant way to look at the structure of the standard model, which is, gets us into grand unification. Okay, so for clarity, let's start by just defining again what the, just be clear about three different models that we'll be comparing, and I want to establish terminology for those two, for those three. Okay, so here is our beloved table. There we have the left-handed quark doublet, the right-handed up and down, the left-handed lepton doublet, let me write the right-handed neutrino, and the right-handed electron, those are the fermions, and then we just have our scalar field Higgs, okay, and this is filled in with some numbers that we haven't yet had a chance to discuss why they are what they are. No one really knows why they are what they are, but part of the goal of later part of the course is to explain some of the best ideas that have been had about that. Okay, so I want to distinguish between three models. The first model, which I'll always call the standard model. Again, we have a choice. We can either, in the standard model, we omit this line. I'll make this line a different color. That doesn't look very different, does it? Okay, well anyway, so that's supposed to be green. I don't know if that's visible or not. It's invisible. Okay. So in any case, we have this special line in the table. In the standard model, what we mean is we omit that line. So we omit the new R row from the Lagrangian table. And we omit, when we're constructing the Lagrangian, we omit all the non-renormalizable terms. Okay, so that's what I'll always mean when I say the standard model. Then we'll want to contrast that with two other models, the standard model effective field theory, where we again omit the new R row, but now we include the non-renormalizable terms. And then a third model, which I'll call the new standard model, the neutrino standard model, is where we include, we do the opposite. Now we include this guy, we include the right-handed neutrino row in the table, and now we omit the non-renormalizable terms in the Lagrangian. So we write down, we're back to a renormalizable Lagrangian. Okay? And what I want to explain in this lecture to sort of is that, okay, so first of all, the standard model has three things that it simply cannot explain. Three observed things about the universe. Okay? Everything else you can imagine, maybe we don't understand something right about how the universe was born or who knows what, but these three, it looks like if you just take the standard model and couple it to Einstein gravity, it simply cannot account for these three things. One being the fact that neutrinos have masses and oscillate, neutrino masses and oscillations. Okay, the second thing is the observed a symmetry between matter and antimatter in the universe. The universe today is made of matter. And finally, dark matter. We seem to need dark matter or something like it. We do, to explain cosmology. And the standard model coupled to ordinary Einstein gravity simply can't do that for you. Okay. So, then, in brief, what we want to explain is that if we extend the standard model to the standard model effective field theory, which in some sense is the most conservative way to extend the standard model, to say we're not going to hypothesize about any new particles or fields, all we're going to say is that we think the standard model is the low energy effective field theory of something, and ask what are the leading order predictions from that assumption. Okay, then that explains, seems to give a perfect explanation for the observed masses, neutrino masses, and oscillations, but it gives no explanation for puzzles 2 and 3. The next most conservative thing is our third model, the neutrino standard model, where we include the right-handed neutrinos. So what we want to try to explain is that does explain all three, or at least it explains this guy, and it gives nice candidate explanations for these two. That in the low energy limit, it reduces to exactly the standard model effective field theory described above. And in addition to explaining more, it sets the stage for more elegant reinterpretations or attempts to understand the structure of the standard model and where it comes from. So I'll just put those under shorthand grand unification theory, or GUT. Okay. Okay, so let's first talk about the standard model effective field theory and how it works. Well, we got to say the beginning of this at the end of the previous lecture. So the point is that it turns out, so in the standard model effective field theory, we take these terms with no right-handed neutrino, and so far, to get the standard model, we wrote down all the terms up to dimension 4 in mass. Now we're going to keep going and adding dimension 5, et cetera. Well, we expect the leading correction terms to be the dimension 5 terms. So, and it turns out there's only one of those, okay? And to see what that is, as we said last time, we noticed that if we define this left-handed spinner psi left to be H twiddle dagger L left, remember H twiddle here is defined to be I sigma 2 H star. So this is a two-component vector that transforms under SU2. This is another two-component vector that transforms under SU2. We've contracted those two indices. And so what we noticed last time is that this is a gauge singlet now. So this carries its spinner index. It transforms like a left-handed spinner, but it carries no gauge indices or gauge charges. And so if we write down its charge conjugate spinner. Remember, the charge conjugate of a spinner is defined to be minus I gamma 2, sorry, the charge conjugate, which I'll call psi L C for charge conjugate, that's defined to be I minus I gamma 2 times the complex conjugate of that spinner. So again, if this thing transforms like a spinner under Lorentz transformations, this thing also transforms like a spinner, but whereas this is a left-handed spinner, meaning that in four-component Dirac notation, it only has non-zero components in the bottom two components. This guy, it transforms like a right chiral spinner, meaning it only has non-zero components in the upper two components. So since this transforms like a left chiral spinner and this guy transforms like a right chiral spinner, instead of our normal kind of mass term, which would be like psi r bar psi l or something like that, we can instead replace this right chiral spinner by psi lc. Okay, we can write down a term like that, and just to, but again, there's three families in the standard model. There's three different flavors of left, I mean, there's three different generations of left-handed leptons. So there's really three different generations of this guy, so we should put a matrix in here. Okay, let me write this differently. I'll put a dimensionless matrix in here to couple the three different families of these guys in all different ways. And then, okay, so a normal spinner has mass dimension 3/2. We've contracted it with a scalar which has mass dimension 1. So this guy has dimension 5/2. So this term so far, if this is a dimensionless matrix, has dimension 5/2 plus 5/2 plus 0 equals 5. To be a term in the Lagrangian, it better have dimension 4. So we have to divide by a mass here, some mass scale. I'll call that mass scale lambda. Okay, so the only dimension 5 term we can add in the standard model looks like this. This term plus its Hermitian conjugate. And, okay, so if you think about it, I won't work this out on the board, but so here we have psi left appearing. Now here, we took a complex conjugate of it, psi left, when we turned it into psi left c. We took another complex conjugate when we took the bar. So really, secretly, we just have the transpose of psi left over here also. And it turns out, if you work it out, that when you take into account the fact that we really just have two copies of psi left I and psi left j here, that the spinner index between them is antisymmetric. Turns out it's an antisymmetric matrix. And meanwhile, spinners anti-commute with each other. It means that in order for this matrix, this term, it's only the symmetric part of Yij doesn't die. Okay, so Yij is a symmetric matrix. It's a complex, so far it's just a complex symmetric matrix. Now, let's focus on, so this is the dimension 5 term we can write down. Now, I want to now explain that this gives a mass to the neutrino. So to see that, we focus on we substitute in, remember H twiddle, this thing looks like 1 over root 2 V0 plus the Higgs boson, V plus the Higgs boson in the upper component, 0 in the lower component. So we can substitute that in, but let's just focus on the term that comes from the VEV. Okay? So when we substitute that in, psi left becomes, well, 0 V0 times this. We'll just select out the new left. This is a new left E left, but we'll just get V times the new left part. So when we focus on the part involving the Higgs VEV here, this becomes, we can rewrite this term as minus 1/2 new left C bar I times a new matrix, which I'll call capital MIJ times new left J plus Hermitian conjugate. Okay, where here I've just defined, I've absorbed the V over root 2 from the Higgs-Vev into V over root 2 times this, I've called this. Okay, so this mass matrix MIJ is just defined to be V over root 2 times our earlier matrix YIJ. And now, okay, so this is a symmetric matrix, so we can diagonalize it. And in particular, if we do a singular value decomposition like we did in the previous lectures, we could write it as V times a diagonal matrix times, we could write it as V dagger times a diagonal matrix times U. But because it's symmetric, V turns out to just be the star of U. So we can diagonalize this guy as U transpose times some real diagonal matrix M hat IJ times U, where U is a unitary matrix. And so then we can, just like we did when we were absorbing things in the Yukawa terms in the standard model, we did these we tried to diagonalize things as much as we could by absorbing unitaries into a redefinition of the field. Let's do that here also. So let's define a new field, new left prime. We'll take the U here times new left and absorb it into a new field, new left prime. Like that. And so then this term becomes new left C bar prime times the diagonal matrix MIJ times new left J, new left prime J plus Hermitian conjugate. And then, you know, then now it's convenient to define this Majorana spinner nu, or let's say nu prime. So nu prime is a four-component Dirac spinner, and we'll define it this way. We'll put nu left prime in the left-handed part of the spinner, and then we'll put its charge conjugate, nu left C prime, up here. So in other words, okay, here, new left prime is this left-handed spinner we defined. So it only has non-zero components in the lower two pieces. If we define the charge conjugate of that spinner, in other words, as usual, minus I gamma 2 times the star of that spinner, well, that's a spinner that only has upper two components. We add those two guys, and that sum is what we define to be nu prime. And this is a Majorana spinner in the sense that what that means is that if you just try taking its charge conjugate, it's a simple exercise to take minus I gamma 2 times nu prime star, where nu prime is given by this, and you'll just find that it's invariant. Okay, so the charge conjugate of nu prime is equal to nu prime. So that's very analogous to when you have a complex scalar field. You can get a real scalar field by imposing the condition that phi star is equal to phi. So this is the analogous, you know, the Majorana condition is just the analogous thing for spinners. It's a way to impose that psi star, roughly speaking, or that nu star is equal to nu. But in order to make it compatible with Lorentz invariance, you have to have this extra, at least in this Weyl basis, you have to have an extra matrix in the way. There's another basis called the Majorana basis, where literally the condition for a Majorana spinner is that nu is equal to nu star. But in the Weyl basis, where you can see the chiralities clearly, you need a little extra piece there. Okay, so the point is, if we define this Majorana spinner, then this term simplifies. It's just nu prime bar times this diagonal matrix MIJ times nu prime. So it looks like an ordinary mass term for a Dirac spinner, or in this case, because this is a 3x3 diagonal matrix, a sum of three ordinary Dirac terms for three Dirac spinners. But this Dirac spinner happens to have this extra condition that its upper and lower halves aren't independent. They've been set equal to the charge conjugate of one another. In other words, instead of having independent particle and antiparticle components, the antiparticle field has been taken to be the antiparticle creation operator is now the same as the particle creation operators in that field. So anyway, so this is just to say that this is the mass term that you get when you add a dimension 5 term in the standard model, and it is a so-called Majorana mass term. Okay, so the prediction of the standard model effective field theory is that the neutrino does have mass, the left-handed neutrino does have mass, but it's a Majorana mass.
Sorry?
Yeah.
The new left that we started with is not an SU2 doublet.
The new left is part of an SU2. This thing is an SU2 doublet, and it has two pieces. New left and E left. So what happened is that when it got contracted, when we focused only on, and this is an SU2 doublet too, but when we focused only on the VEV piece, it breaks the symmetry, remember? So it looks like when we look at the symmetry broken expression, it looks like this term now only involves new left.
Okay.
That's because we've just focused on the VEV piece. Okay, so let me see. Is there anything else I wanted to say about that?
How your mass is related to why wouldn't there be like a 2 Higgs VEV and then divided by your scale lambda?
Thank you. I'm sorry. This is completely wrong. Whoops. Thanks. Thank you very much. Sorry. I was thinking about a later expression and I wrote the wrong thing here. So, if we focus on the VEV part here, we get a V over root 2 here, and a V over root 2 times new left here, and a V over root 2 times new left here. So we get V squared over 2 times lambda times this thank you, sorry about that. Okay, so the mass matrix looks like this. And in particular, actually that's a good point, because this is sometimes called the seesaw mass for the light neutrinos, because it goes as the square of the Higgs VEV divided by some whatever high energy scale is associated with the physics that we integrated out. And so the higher you make that high energy scale, lambda, which, as we'll see in a moment, will most naturally be interpreted as the mass scale of the other right-handed neutrinos that we haven't introduced yet. But anyway, so as you make the high energy scale higher, the predicted masses of the light neutrinos get smaller. That's one way to view the so-called seesaw mechanism. Now, again, notice something else to notice is that when we defined new left prime to be equal to a unitary matrix times new left, that is closely analogous to when in the previous, maybe two lectures ago, when we were trying to massage all of the unphysical parameters out of the standard model, we found that we could absorb a lot of the unitary matrices in field redefinitions in the quark sector, but there was one unitary we couldn't get rid of, which was the CKM matrix. Okay, and we said that physically, what this ends up representing is that these are the mass eigenstates, and these are the weak. Eigenstates. And there's something exactly analogous going on here. So before we introduced dimension 5 operators, we had no such issue in the lepton sector, but now when we do introduce the dimension 5 terms, now we find that there's an analogous thing in the lepton sector, that there's an unremovable discrepancy between the mass eigenstates of the neutrino and the weak eigenstates of the neutrino. Or in other words, if we have an electron of type 1 coming in, you know, what you would normally call an electron, as opposed to a muon or a tau. So let's say an electron comes in and it emits W minus and turns into a, so a left-handed electron comes in and it turns into a left-handed neutrino of the first type, so what you would normally call a left-handed electron neutrino. Well, that is equal now. That's the weak eigenstate. The electron neutrino is when you say electron neutrino, you're talking about the weak eigenstate, the thing that gets produced when an E emits a W minus. But that's not a mass eigenstate according to this. We would need to apply a use. This is so the ith weak eigenstate here is U dagger ij times the jth mass eigenstate. So what actually gets emitted here is some linear combination of three different mass eigenstates. And so suppose, for example, that a cosmic ray comes down and hits the atmosphere and produces an electron neutrino through an event like this. So the electron neutrino here is where it gets produced. But it's now a linear combination of three different mass eigenstates. And so if you now ask how those three mass eigenstates propagate, well, one of them propagates with a certain mass, so its phase oscillates at a certain rate. But another one with a bigger mass, its phase oscillates at a different rate, and another one with an even smaller mass, you know, it's. So the point is, the three mass eigenstates will propagate with different phase oscillation lengths. And so we had when this thing was produced, it was a certain linear combination of these three waves. But now, when it hits the detector down here, it'll be a different linear combination of these three different waves. And so it will have converted from an electron-type neutrino to not purely an electron-type neutrino, some combination of a mu and a tau-type neutrino. And so when it hits this detector, instead of just producing an electron in the detector through an inverse of this process, it might produce a muon or it might produce a tau. And so anyway, it's by experiments like that that you observe that neutrinos do indeed oscillate between flavors, and that's, anyway, so the point is the standard model effective field theory explains that. Okay, so let's see. So the standard model effective field theory so far is working great. It seems to beautifully describe the neutrino oscillations that we see experimentally in various ways. So the next thing since it's doing so well, the next natural step is to go one step further and look for the dimension 6 operators and see what they predict. Well, it turns out there are a lot of dimension 6 operators, but a key point is that what they predict is that baryon number is violated. Okay, so baryon number is an example. So whenever you have a quark, it has baryon. It's defined to have baryon number equals 1/3. And whenever you have a lepton, it is defined to have baryon number equals 0, and an anti-quark has baryon number minus 1/3, and the Higgs and the gauge bosons all have baryon number 0. And in the ordinary standard model Lagrangian, if you look at all the terms you can write down, none of them permit processes that where the baryon number in the initial state differs from the baryon number in the final state. So it looks like baryon number is conserved in the standard model. But it turns out that's not a fundamental symmetry in the standard model. It's just a so-called accidental symmetry. It's a symmetry that only appears to be a symmetry if you only look at the renormalizable terms in the Lagrangian, but once you begin including non-renormalizable terms, it's broken. And so anyway, to make a long story short, the dimension six in the standard model effective field theory is where that breaking appears. And so the salient prediction here is that the proton, which so far, if baryon number is conserved, the proton can't decay because there is no lighter state in which a proton at rest can decay into that also has baryon number 1, which the proton has. But once you include dimension 6 operators, it should be able to decay. Okay, and exactly how fast it should decay depends on parameters in the dimension 6 terms that we have not measured yet. But if the dimension 6 terms, so the dimension 5 term we saw was suppressed by 1 power of this mass scale 1 over lambda. And so roughly speaking, the expectation is that the dimension 6 terms should be suppressed by 1 over lambda squared. And you know, that means that we're in the ball game. This prediction that the proton should decay, unfortunately, we don't know it precisely enough to know how hard this will be to detect. But the predicted decay rate here is, on the one hand, it is small enough that it is not, that the standard model effective field theory is not ruled out by the fact that we haven't seen protons decay yet. On the other hand, it's large enough that it's very conceivable that ongoing proton decay searches, although they haven't detected proton decay yet, will detect it. So anyway, that's one important thing to say about the standard model effective field theory. And but it can't explain, as we said before, it can't explain items 2 and 3. So just to say, in short, it can't explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry in the universe. There's two ways to say that. There are famous criteria for creating the matter and antimatter asymmetry due to Sakharov, the so-called Sakharov criteria, which are that baryon number, in order to create the fundamental laws of physics, if you want to start with a universe which is in thermal equilibrium at early times during the radiation era, which our universe appears to have been. Yeah?
This is back for the, so I'm pretty confused. Is lambda supposed to be like gut scale lambda? Or?
Indeed, it seems to be, okay, so.
Because I don't see why we would expect them to be related by 1 over lambda and 1 over lambda squared. Why not just A and B, where A and B have to vanish as lambda gets large?
That's a good question. We don't strictly know. Let me say two different things in answer to that question. Most important thing to say is that we don't know. It's a guess, but the first thing to say is that if you look at that matrix capital MIJ is equal to V squared over lambda, we measure, or at least roughly speaking, we have measured the left-hand side of that equation. We know how big the light neutrino masses are in the standard model. Meanwhile, we've also measured little v. We know that's some precise value, 246 GeV. But what we don't know yet is we don't know separately what lambda and capital Yij are. If you assume that the Yijs are, normally you want to assume that they're smaller than one, roughly speaking, or else perturbative field theory breaks down. On the other hand, if you assume they're not too much smaller than one so that you don't have to do any more tuning than you need to, if they're of order one, then it turns out that the observed masses that we see of the light neutrinos imply that lambda is a very high scale, comparable to the gut scale, something like 10 to the 15 GeV or something. But the first thing to say is that we don't know that that picture is right. It could be that the capital Y elements are smaller than that, in which case lambda could also be significantly smaller than that, for example. On the other hand, okay, so let's go to the second part of your question. Assume that it is the case that the capital Ys are of order one and that lambda is of order of the gut scale. In effective field theory, the ordinary expectation is that if you start with the thing which happens in examples, although strictly speaking you can also cook up examples that violate this by using symmetries and so forth, but generically speaking, what happens is that if you have a renormalizable field theory with some particles living at some energy scale lambda. And then we'll talk about this in a minute. We'll see more detail what I'm talking about here later in the lecture. But and then you say, I'm restricted to an energy scale way below that mass scale, so I can integrate out those particles and work with an effective field theory way below that. Then what happens is that you end up getting, generically, in the low energy effective field theory, all of these non-renormalizable terms of dimension 5, 6, blah blah blah. And generically, they all have coefficients that are order one dimensionless coefficients, all divided by the same scale, lambda, to an appropriate power. So that's what one is assuming here, that if this is order one times the appropriate scale, one over lambda, that this should be order one times one over lambda squared, barring any special constructions in the theory to set these terms to be smaller than naive. That's really what I'm saying. But we don't know. I mean, again, you can come up with examples where there's no baryon, no proton decay. Good question. Okay, so let's see. I just want to give a brief flavor of this, why it can't explain items 2 and 3 here. Well, items 2, you're supposed to have Sakharov pointed out that if you want the universe to start in thermal equilibrium at early times, where the thermal equilibrium abundances of particles and antiparticles are the same because they have the same mass and they're at the same temperature, then to get from that state to a later state where they're abundant, where the particle and baryon and antibaryon abundances are different, the fundamental physics has to satisfy three criteria. It has to violate B. It has to violate C and CP, and there has to be a deviation from thermal equilibrium. The thermal equilibrium has to be violated. Okay, now in the standard model, there's basically turned out to be two problems. In the ordinary standard model, according to that definition that we started with, there's two problems with that. First of all, the only CP violation in the standard model is the complex phase that we couldn't remove from the CKM matrix, and it turns out to be a very small complex phase. Okay, so the CP violation is very small in the ordinary standard model without extra neutrinos. And secondly, once upon a time, people hoped that as you went through the electroweak phase transition, that there would be a very violent phase transition as the Higgs went from having zero VeV to non-zero VeV, and that there would be a first order phase transition with bubbles of new phase crashing into each other and big violations of thermal equilibrium. Now it turns out that now that we know that what the Higgs mass is, we know that's not true. Okay, so the phase transition isn't even strictly speaking a phase transition; it's a smooth crossover. So the standard model can't satisfy these criteria. It just can't make enough. If the standard model was all there was, then as the universe cooled down, nearly all of the particles and antiparticles would annihilate, and we would end up with just an almost completely empty universe today. And so why can't it explain dark matter? Well, there's just no dark matter candidate in the model. There's no, you know, the minimal thing that you need to be a dark matter candidate is that you need to be, we've seen all of the particles in the standard model by itself now. And none of them have the properties that they can be the dark matter. The only stable particles are the proton and electron, which can't be the dark matter. And the three light neutrinos, which for other reasons can't be, are ruled out as the dark matter. So let me, for the sake of time, not go into more detail there, except that to say it can't do dark matter. Okay. I forgot to bring any snacks this time. I apologize. So I've got nothing, but nevertheless, I feel it's time for a quick break. Anyone has my, so you had the whole weekend to come up with a joke to tell the room or something about, okay, I'll go again. I'm hoping shame will creep in over time. I remember that when I keep going back to the thing now that keeps springing to mind is going over to my grandmother's house. When I went there, this must have been when I was 6 or 7. My favorite thing to watch was professional wrestling, and my favorite wrestlers were the Road Warriors. It's probably before your guys' time, but anyway. But my grandmother's favorite thing to watch was Golden Girls, and so I remember that we watched a lot of that. Also probably a show maybe before your time, but so anyway, we watched a lot of Golden Girls and not that much professional wrestling. Okay. Has anybody ever seen this show Golden Girls? It's, you know, it's for a certain type of audience, it's a great show. Okay. So, now let's talk about the standard model, including right-handed neutrinos, the new SM. So now we add back the right-handed neutrino row to our table, and now we write down the most general renormalizable Lagrangian. And so the Lagrangian now has three new terms. Okay, so there's the first two, there's the same bosonic terms as in the standard model. In other words, when we previously wrote down the Lagrangian for the standard model, the first line was the gauge boson kinetic terms, and then the scalar field kinetic terms and potential terms, and those are unchanged. Then the third line, we wrote down the kinetic term for the fermions. So we had one term, basically, for each fermion field on our list, on our table over there. So you write D slash U right plus D right D slash D right plus L left D slash L left, and now we get to write new right D slash new right plus E right D slash E right. Okay, so that's the first new term we get to add. So now you see the kinetic terms for the quarks, the left-handed doublet and the two right-handed singlets, are parallel to the kinetic term for the fermions, the left-handed doublet and the two corresponding right-handed singlets under SU2. And then we had the Yukawa terms, so we had two for the quarks. There was one where the left-handed quark doublet couples through a 3x3 Yukawa matrix to the Higgs and the down quark, and the second one where the left-handed quark doublet couples through a different Yukawa matrix to the Higgs twiddle and the up quark. And then now we have the parallel terms. We have both of the parallel terms that we can write down in the lepton sector. So we have the left-handed lepton doublet can now couple through a Yukawa matrix YE. This is the term we wrote down previously, and to the times the Higgs times the right-handed electron. And now, so those were the three terms we had in the standard model, and now we get to write a new one, which is the analog, the lepton analog of this term, which is the left-handed lepton doublet couples through a new Yukawa matrix, which I'll call Y sub nu, times Higgs twiddle times the right-handed neutrino. Okay, so that's sometimes called the Dirac Yukawa coupling for the right-handed neutrino. So that's our second new term. Okay, I'll bracket our three new terms. So that's one new term. That's the second new term. Okay, but then we're not done yet. There's one other new term that we can write down. So again, because the right-handed neutrino is the only field on this table that has the property that it's a singlet under, it transforms trivially under all the gauge groups. It's trivial under SU3, trivial under SU2, trivial under U1. For it, we can write down a Majorana-Mass term. Remember that we could only get away with that when we were working with a neutral fermion, which this is. So we can define its charge conjugate, bar, times a mass matrix, which I will call M sub M for Majorana, times nu right J. Okay, so we can write down so everybody else, remember, we couldn't write down any explicit mass terms for any of the other fields in the standard model. All we were able to do was write down Yukawa couplings to the Higgs, and then when the Higgs got a VEV, then they got effective masses. But for this right-handed neutrino, it's the only field for which we can now write down an explicit mass term that doesn't depend on any coupling to any scalar field. It just has a explicit matrix here, which has dimensions of mass. And okay, now the idea, now that opens up a possibility, which is that, as we'll see, since this mass term appears to be unconnected to the Higgs VEV, if its characteristic size is much bigger than the Higgs VEV, then there ends up being this, then we end up getting this so-called seesaw mechanism where we'll get three very heavy neutrino mass eigenstates, which are essentially built from nu right, and which have masses which are given by this mass, the mass matrix capital M sub M. So those might be up at the gut scale. And then we get three very light neutrinos, which are almost completely built from nu left, and their size is given by the seesaw formula, something like the analog of the seesaw formula we saw before. It's given by, we'll see in a second, but it goes like the Higgs VEV squared over this mass here. Okay, so let's see how that works. So I am not going to do a proper QFT calculation of this. I'm just going to motivate the answer as follows. I want to restrict myself. In EFT, in effective field theory, the idea is I restrict myself to fluctuations of momentum, of energy momentum, less than some cutoff scale. So in particular, for the standard model, I should say this more clearly. What I want to explain first here is I want to explain the thing which I mentioned before, that if we look at low energies, we can integrate out the right-handed neutrino from this full Lagrangian and recover the standard model effective field theory Lagrangian that we saw before. I want to say that this model really recovers the standard model effective field theory at low energies. So now the idea is that imagine that because this matrix is not tied to the Higgs VEV, it may have a value much higher than the electroweak scale. Its entries may be much larger than the electroweak energy. To a first approximation, we ignore these other terms, and we have these particles with Majorana masses that are way above the electroweak scale. Well, then if we do effective field theory at the electroweak scale, we don't allow ourselves particles to move around with momenta bigger than the electroweak scale, energy or momenta bigger than the electroweak scale. Well, the minimum energy required to actually excite the kinetic term for such a particle, is that mass scale. So, in other words, what I'm trying to say is that in that regime, we can ignore the kinetic term for this particle. We're restricting ourselves simply to too low energies to be able to actually excite an actual propagating mode of that field. So let's ignore the kinetic term. But if we ignore the new right d slash new right term, but if we ignore that term, then the remaining terms appear undifferentiated. So then new right becomes like a Lagrange multiplier in the action. So when we derive its Euler-Lagrange equation, again, ignoring the kinetic term, we get a constraint equation. So normally the Euler-Lagrange equation, it's a no-no to derive the Euler-Lagrange equation for a field, solve it, and then use that solution to remove that field from the Lagrangian. But if it's a constraint equation, if it's an equation not involving time derivatives, then that's okay. Then the Lagrangian where you've eliminated the field does still give the correct equations of motion for the remaining fields. So that's what we'll do here. So the Euler-Lagrange equation for new right is, if we vary that action, we find that we just get two terms, minus L bar y nu h twiddle minus nu r c bar matrix capital M sub m equals zero. And so I won't do it on the board, but this is just some matrix equation for that we can solve for nu right. And then we can plug that solution for new right back into that action. And when we find that, when we do that, we find that this term, when we use the solution and eliminate this term, we get a certain expression with a minus 1/2 in front. Our solution for new right into this term, we get that same expression again, but with a coefficient of plus 1. So the plus 1 cancels the minus 1/2. So we just get, the point is that these two terms, once we plug in the solution for new right, they reduce, they look the same. They just have different coefficients in front of them. So they combine to give a mass term, which looks like, again, I won't do the algebra on the board, but if you're interested, it's just a little bit of substitution in algebra. It looks like nu left C, bar I, mij, nu left J, plus Hermitian conjugate. In other words, the same expression that we had before in the standard model effective field theory, but now where we have an expression for this mass, this was the mass matrix that appeared in the standard model effective field theory on those boards, but now we have an expression for it in terms of the parameters appearing in the new SM, which is that it's equal to minus m nu mm inverse m nu transpose, where here m nu I've just defined to be v over root 2 times y nu. This is the formula that I had mistakenly written on the other board, but in other words, we had these two matrices appearing that coupling to the right-handed neutrino, this Yukawa matrix and this mass matrix. Let me absorb the VEV into this guy and redefine it as the mass matrix M sub nu. Then what happens is that the light neutrinos, when we integrate out the right-handed neutrino, we get an expression like this. And the masses here for the light neutrinos, the three light neutrinos, are given by this famous seesaw expression that they're proportional to two powers of the Dirac mass matrix, the mass matrix that comes from the coupling to the Higgs. In other words, that's proportional to Y nu times the Higgs VEV. But then they're proportional to the inverse of this matrix, M sub M. They're proportional to the inverse of the heavy neutrino masses. So in other words, the heavy neutrino masses in this model are, to a first approximation, given by diagonalizing this matrix, M sub M. They're very big. The light neutrino masses are given by diagonalizing this matrix. And the bigger this is, the smaller this guy is, because it goes as m sub m to the minus 1. So anyway, that's the so-called seesaw mechanism. I think that if you'll allow me 2 minutes, I can give the gist of why it is that this theory can explain the matter-antimatter asymmetry and dark matter. Okay, so let's first talk about the solution to the matter-antimatter asymmetry. So in other words, is it clear what I've tried to explain here is that the solution to the first problem in this language can be seen in a couple of different ways, but the bottom line is that in this Lagrangian predicts that there are now 6 neutrino mass eigenstates, 3 very heavy ones, which have a Majorana mass term like that, and 3 very light ones, which have a Majorana mass term like that, which is exactly the same Majorana mass term that we had in the standard model effective field theory that just described the low energy. So it solves problem 1. Problem 2, the matter-antimatter asymmetry. In short, it explains we can now explain that by a method called leptogenesis. So what happens is that, just like over here, I took nu left and its charge conjugate, nu left C, and I combine them into a Majorana fermion, nu prime. Over here, I can combine nu right and nu right C into a Majorana fermion, which is commonly called capital N. Okay, so this is a Majorana fermion, so it's equal to its own antiparticle. So it has, if you look at the vertices available, the interaction vertices available to it, it has a decay where it decays to a Higgs particle and a left-handed lepton. But since it's equal to its own antiparticle, it also has a decay channel where it decays into the anti-state of this. So it decays into a into a Higgs into the antiparticle of this doublet and the corresponding antilepton. Now, if CP were conserved, if we could have removed all of the complex phases, if we could have absorbed all of the complex phases in the leptonic part of the Lagrangian into field redefinitions, then it turns out you can show that these two decay rates, those two branching fractions would have to be equal. But since we can't, since there are unremovable complex phases, analogous to the CKM phase in the quark sector, these will not be equal to one another. And so what can happen in the early universe is, at very early times when the universe is very hot, this particle, this heavy neutrino, is in thermal equilibrium. As the universe cools down, the temperature eventually drops below the mass of the heavy neutrino. Its abundance begins to be strongly suppressed by the Boltzmann factor. It begins to become dilute. Eventually, as it becomes more and more dilute, the reactions that keep it in thermal equilibrium with the rest of the standard model, the rate goes down because there's fewer and fewer of these particles around to react. And so eventually, it becomes the case that the rate for maintaining thermal equilibrium, the reaction rates necessary for maintaining thermal equilibrium become slower than the Hubble rate, and this particle falls out of equilibrium. The reactions necessary to hold it at this abundance are simply not happening fast enough to maintain this very rapid exponential suppression of its abundance. And so instead it falls out of equilibrium, and it instead ends up for a while with an abundance a lot bigger than its equilibrium abundance. But it's an unstable particle, so eventually it decays. It decays into this and this, but in unequal amounts. And so you end up getting an excess of leptons over antileptons, or vice versa. So you end up with a lepton asymmetry. But then it turns out that the phase transition, when symmetry is broken at the electroweak phase transition, or above the electroweak phase transition also, that there are processes in the standard model that convert a lepton asymmetry into a baryon asymmetry. So what the decay directly produces a lepton asymmetry, which is why this process is called leptogenesis. But the point is that the standard model above the electroweak scale, when the temperature is higher than the electroweak scale, converts lepton asymmetry into the observed baryon asymmetry very efficiently. So that's in short how this model permits a solution of the baryon of the matter antimatter asymmetry. And for dark matter, the point simply is that, well, now if you ask, is there a dark matter candidate in this model? Well, two things a dark matter candidate has to be. It has to be stable. It has to live for at least the age of the universe, preferably much longer, because of certain observational constraints. And it has to be a particle we haven't detected yet. So is there such a particle in the extended model here? Yes. It turns out that there's one of the three heavy neutrinos fits the bill, can be the dark matter. And then there's a question of, Can this model naturally produce that dark matter candidate in the early universe? And again, the answer is yes. And there's two candidate explanations. One goes under one is sometimes called the new MSM, which has been studied a lot by Shaposhnikov and collaborators, but also others. And to make a long story short, this just says that these heavy neutrinos are produced by the thermal bath in the early universe, thermally, and that would be great. It turns out that this ends up predicting that although these are heavier than the neutrinos we know and love, they have to be quite light. They have to be about 1 keV. So in other words, lighter than the electron, actually. And okay, so this approach to producing these particles is actually under experimental duress from cosmological observations, but at least if you talk to some people, you can make it still work. So Shaposhnikov would say you can make it still work. So anyway, that's one possible way to produce this guy in the early universe. And then something that with Neil Turok and my former student Kieran Finn, we pointed out another way to which I personally think is much more natural, where this particle is produced in the early universe, which is if there's a natural vacuum state for the fields on our cosmological background to be in, which is this so-called CPT symmetric state. And if these neutrinos are in that, if the universe is really in that vacuum state, then to a late time observer, it will appear that those neutrinos have been, a certain abundance of those neutrinos have been radiated from the Big Bang, in exactly analogous to how in Hawking radiation, if the black hole is really in the state we think it is in, then to an observer far from the black hole, it will seem like particles are being radiated from the horizon of the black hole. So anyway, so that's just to give you the gist that there is a dark matter candidate in this model, definitely in the sense that it's stable and we haven't detected, in the sense that it can be stable and we haven't detected it yet. How exactly it would be produced in the early universe is still an open question. There are at least two possibilities. Anyway, so my personal bet actually is that this is where the dark matter is, but of course it remains to be seen. But the bottom line is that the new SSM, the neutrino standard model, at least offers a possibility to explain all three of these puzzles. And then, as I want to explain later in the week, it turns out that just expanding the table by that one row allows a very neat reinterpretation of what's going on. So. That's all I was going to say. Now